listener production.
Being the Australian Federal Treasurer would arguably have to be one of the toughest jobs in our country right now.
And I call the Treasurer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
So who is Josh Frydenberg behind the suit and away from cabinet doors?
Australia is coming back.
In this episode, I sit down with Josh to discuss his journey into politics, his role as a father and husband, and his reflections on some of the most challenging moments in his career to date.
In the face of a once-in-a-century pandemic, the Australian spirit has shone through.
We talk about what the future may look like as we deal with COVID-19 and unmask the power shifts between state and federal government.
Fundamental decisions in the daily lives of Victorians or people in New South Wales or indeed any other state are being determined by the Premier in a way that has not been the case previously.
My name is Sarah Grinberg. Each month, Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg and I will discuss the topics affecting our lives as Australians. In a time where transparency is critical, Josh will answer the important questions often not asked in the media. This is the Josh Frydenberg Podcast with Sarah Grinberg. Josh, you have arguably one of the toughest jobs in Australia right now. But let's start at the beginning. How were the younger years? You grew up in Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah, g'day, Sarah. I've got a challenging job, but I suppose no more challenging than our frontline health workers right now or our Defence Force personnel who are deployed overseas or so many other people who work pretty tough day on night jobs. But it's a privilege to serve in this portfolio and in government, and no one could have expected this pandemic. Certainly we didn't. And it's created a lot of challenges, but also I'm very proud of what the Australian people have been able to achieve over the course of the last 18 months, but we're not through it yet. With respect to my own personal journey, well, I never thought I'd be sitting here talking to you in a podcast as the Treasurer because if I had my way, I'd be hitting tennis balls somewhere around Europe right now. That was what I dreamt of as a kid, leaving school, chasing my tennis dream and making a career of it. I got a chance to do that, but I quickly realised that my ambitions were far greater than my talents. But I had a really good family upbringing, loving parents, great sister, supportive household, and great friends through school. And I had a couple of schools during the course of my time, Bialik College and Mount Scopus College, which were two really good schools. So I feel like, I was given a great platform, to go on with life, and went to uni, took a year off to travel overseas. That was time spent playing tennis, settled in at Monash, and then got to work in various roles in law firms, in banks, obviously in Parliament House too. And then back in 2010, got elected to the Parliament, and here we are now.
Before I call the member for Kooyong, remind the House that this is the Honourable Member's first speech, and I ask the House to extend to him the usual courtesies. The member for Kooyong.
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I am honoured and privileged to represent the people of Kooyong. I see my journey to this place in the continuum of my family's story.
Your mum, Erica, is a psychologist, and your dad, Harry, is a surgeon. Sister Lexi, that you mentioned before, is a paediatrician, so a very intelligent family. What were the core...
And a superstar wife, by the way, as well.
And a superstar wife. What are the core values that your parents instilled in you and your sister when you were growing up?
Hard work. Both parents worked pretty long hours. They were also really good contributors to the community, and they emphasised the importance of that part of one's vocation. In the case of my mum, as you say, she was a psychologist. My dad was a surgeon, so they improved people's lives. And my sister, she's the smart one in the family. She's gone on to be the paediatrician, and she's really making a great difference there. So they taught me about hard work. They taught me about giving back to the community. They certainly led by example in terms of, having close family and friends and the importance of that nurturing environment. And then I suppose they also gave me unconditional love.
Yeah.
And as a parent now, that's something I try to instill in my kids. And that was, you know, the best thing that a parent could ever give. And I felt like I was on the receiving end of that. The other thing they taught me, Sarah, is just, you know, follow your dream. Mm. I had a little sign up on my door at home when I was living at home with my parents that I had for year 12, which said, the pain of discipline is far easier than the pain of regret.
Oh, and I love
put
that.
And I put it up because I really didn't want to finish year 12. I actually, you know, I was
You wanted to play tennis.
I was desperate to play tennis. Yeah. And we did a sort of deal with my parents. I'll finish year 12, give it a good whack, and then I can go and chase the dream after that. So that's what I did. And I had that sign on my door to remind myself, you know, don't think about those warm days hitting tennis balls on some clay court in Europe, but actually just knuckle down, get this thing done, this HSC, now VCE, and, you know, then you can do what you like after that. And my parents gave me opportunity to follow my dream, encouraged me to do so, but there was unfinished business first, which was that year 12 year.
You, as you mentioned, played at professional level against Mark Philippoussis and Pat Rafter.
Well, they were certainly better than me, I could tell you.
How did you then pivot from that when you realised that wasn't going any further to want to get into politics?
Well, like I said, I never dreamt as a kid of going into politics, anything but. Once I went to uni and I studied law and I wasn't a member of any political party, but I did run for positions in the student union, you know, like doing stuff with the library or doing stuff with the sports clubs or, you know, things like that. And then I ended up running to be the president of the Law Student Society. And that was a bloody contested election, probably one of the hardest I've fought. And it was a three-cornered race and there was three tickets and I think it must have been, you know, more than a dozen or 15 people on each ticket. And we really put a huge amount of effort and we got there and that was a big job, you know, trying to run the Law Student Society. You know, you had to have the big annual barbecues, your monthly barbecues, whatever they were. You had to have the annual law ball, I remember that. You had to have careers days and all that sort of stuff, which was fun. And, you know, the best thing ever was you had a little office there for the what was called the LSS, the Law Student Society. And so you felt like that was pretty good. But it sort of was a taste of politics. And I went to a law firm after that. I got introduced to Greg Hunt, who's now obviously the health minister and a very close friend. And we discussed his experience living and studying overseas, which I ended up doing. And then that was a platform or an entree to get into politics because he'd worked for Alexander Downer. Mm. And that's who I ended up working for as well. They were, you know, great years. And once I got the taste of politics up in Canberra and I could see what good things could be done through those political roles, I wanted to pursue that myself. And I did so when the opportunity came.
In August 2018, you were elected Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party and appointed Treasurer of Australia by Prime Minister Scott Morrison. How was that moment?
Yeah, it was quite surreal, actually, because we had a leadership contest and, you know, I'd supported Malcolm Turnbull when he was Prime Minister, just as I supported Tony Abbott when he was Prime Minister. And I hadn't thought about running for any of the positions. And some friends came to me, some colleagues, and they said, you know, when this all comes to a head, because at that stage it was clear that there was going to be a ballot and the current deputy, then current deputy, Julie Bishop, was going to run for the leadership. So the deputy's position was going to become available. And Greg Hunt, who I talked about, was going to run for that. And he and I discussed it. And other colleagues came to me and said that wanted me to consider running, and I decided to do that. At the last minute, made some phone calls over those pretty crazy couple of days and got the gig. And then once you got the gig of being the deputy leader, you get the first choice of portfolios.
Yeah.
And I remember going back to Scott's office, and he was then treasurer, but he'd been elected the leader of the party room, so his office then is my office now. And we sat down, just the two of us, and he said, well, what portfolio do you want? And I said, well, Treasury. And I'd spoken to John Howard before that, and he's someone who's a mentor and a friend, and he said, you know, that's the portfolio that you should take if you get the opportunity. And I didn't take too long to reach that conclusion in my own mind, although I'd always wanted to be Foreign Affairs Minister.
Yes.
So to become the Treasurer when I could have become the Foreign Affairs Minister, that I suppose was a decision to take, but I have no regrets. It's been fascinating in the role and I'm really enjoying it. It's challenging and it's important.
Mr. Speaker, together Australia will come back. Together we will rebuild the economy and secure Australia's future. I commend this bill to the House.
How did it feel when you went to bed that night?
Well, it's funny that because, well, smile on the face. It felt personally very fulfilling, but also a sense that there was a big task ahead. And if you remember back to that time, Sarah, no one really thought we were going to win the election.
No.
There was so much chaos and uncertainty. And so people just thought it was a matter of weeks, months before Bill Shorten became Prime Minister and the Labor Party became the government. And so we knew that we had a really big task ahead of us, the first of which was to unite what was a pretty fractured party room and bring all the colleagues together. So it was fulfilling to know that I'd been given this opportunity, but it was also in the full knowledge that and the coming weeks and months were going to be pretty challenging. But, yeah, I felt pretty good about the developments and, you know, to be honest, I didn't really have a lot of expectations because it sort of all happened so quickly.
And so when you were then actually elected in by the Australian people, that feeling must have been incredible.
Yeah, well, I have to confess I didn't necessarily think we were going to win. We had, you know, I've never talked about this before, but the night before the election, I always have my closest friends over.
And you still have a lot of your friends from when you were your school friends.
Yeah, and it's a Friday night. Elections are on a Saturday. And my mum puts on a family Sabbath meal and I bring my closest mates around the dinner table. And by that stage on the Friday night before the election, all the plans are being put into place. All the things you've been working for the last few weeks, it's all come to a head. Lots of votes have already been cast in the pre-poll. And you've got teams of people who are out dressing what are called the, you know, the polling booths. And really, it's organised. And there are hundreds of people who are basically working out on your behalf and the party's behalf. And so you feel like, okay, that part of the job is done. And it's now in the hands of the gods. So I have my friends around for dinner and we say to each other, okay, let's make the predictions about tomorrow. What do you think is going to happen to the government and what do you think is going to happen in my own seat, Kuyong? Because I had a pretty tough contest there. I had high-profile independent who spent lots of money. I had a high-profile Green. I had a strong candidate from the Labor Party and everything else in between. My friends wrote down their various things and I wrote down and I thought we were going to lose and by a handful of seats. I thought I'd win mine, but I knew it was going to be close. And then that next day, you know, Scott was working late, travelling around the country. We spoke a number of times through the course of the day. Could it be a hung parliament? May we just get there? You know. And to his credit, he had the faith that we would get there and that miracle would happen. And it turned out that way. And, geez, I've never been at a party like that one, not even my wedding. But it was such a party that night. We all gathered in the local tennis club in my electorate and there were hundreds of people and it was heaving. And Amy and I sort of came in probably about 9:30 when the results started to come in and all the cameras were there. And, geez, I tell you what, it was one of the best, certainly best probably political night of my life, but one of the best nights of my life.
Well, friends, tonight We have great news in Kooyong! And I've just got off the phone to the Prime Minister, and nationally, we are in the game!
I remember seeing that. It looked amazing. What did your friends, when they were predicting if you would win or not, what did they all write on the piece of paper?
Well, some thought I think we could get there, but they all thought I'd win my seat, which was encouraging.
Yeah.
But, I mean, mainly I think people thought we'd just fall short overall. It was quite a remarkable night. I have to confess, too, this is quite funny. I'd never watched the election night coverage because, yeah. You know, you're surrounded by people, you're hearing results as they come in. So the other night with a friend, I went back and watched the ABC election night coverage.
How was that?
It was quite saddening to watch because, you know, the night they had these panellists from the Labor Party and others, and they were all so buoyant and ready to go and thinking, you know, it was a champagne popping event, and you could see as the results were coming in, it was dawning on them, shit, this thing's not going their way. And so it was quite entertaining to watch that. Anyway, you can't dwell on the past, you focus on the future, but it was something to go back and watch.
What beautiful, beautiful moment. Josh, in February 2020, you faced a challenge from a constituent regarding the dual citizenship of your mother, who was obviously born in Hungary but escaped due to World War II and the Holocaust, and she ended up coming to Australia as a refugee. That must have been so unbelievably emotionally taxing on you and your family.
I think so. I know so. It was very unnecessary. I thought it was nasty, vindictive and spiteful. But, you know, the court, to their credit, assessed the case on the merits and threw it out with costs. They decided that and, you know, the judgment is there for people to read, and it does detail the experience of the Jewish people through that, you know, horrible period of time.
When something like that happens and it becomes all the more personal, and I know you're obviously a huge public figure and you have to deal with things like that, but when you know it's affecting something that happened to your mother, how do you deal with that?
Well, firstly, I was really comforted by the fact that so many good people from both sides of the political divide, you know, have to, you know, say Tanya Plibersek was one.
Yeah.
Ed Husic was another. They called it out for what it was. Noel Pearson wrote a cracking piece. Never spoke to him about it, and he just wrote this piece about the case and others too. And people gave speeches in Parliament about it, colleagues and others. And for me, that was comforting to know that good people saw through that tactic. And I'm glad that the court made the decision that it did.
Did you ever think this could be the end?
No, because if for some reason you lost that case, then you would front up at a by-election and I would have backed my chances.
Yes.
Yeah. Our cherished way of life has been put on hold. We are a resilient people, a proud nation, and we will get through this together. The Great Depression and two world wars did not bring Australia to its knees, and neither will COVID-19.
When was the moment last year that you first realised the severity of the COVID situation? Do you remember what you were doing?
Well, we're getting briefings, you know, regularly at the start, and when I went to Saudi Arabia for a G20 meeting, it was the Singaporean minister, I think it was the Korean, who was speaking about the impact. The Singaporean and the Korean were speaking about the impact of the pandemic, which was just starting, really, on their economies. And it sort of dawned upon me, you know, how significant this potentially could be. At that stage, we were still thinking about a surplus. And then when we closed the international borders, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And then we, you know, saw the international student numbers dry up and a whole lot of other consequential impacts. And then, of course, you had those heady days when all the restrictions were put in place and the economy was effectively put on life support for a period. It was pretty dramatic. And I spent a lot of time away from home, and that was hard because, you know, I've got a loving family, my wife, and
it was two beautiful kids. Over 200 days.
Yeah, hundreds of days have been spent away from home over the course of this pandemic. But again, you know, my situation is probably not too dissimilar to a lot of other people who have been required elsewhere.
So as the treasurer, how did it feel to see so many Australians lining up outside Centrelink? I mean, that must have been heartbreaking for you.
Well, that was very confronting because, you know, seasoned economic commentators were calling those scenes reminiscent of what was seen in Australia during the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And that was our greatest fear, that there would be large numbers of people who would lose their jobs and then kept out of the labour market for years and years and years, bearing in mind that the experience of the 1980s and 1990s recession was that it took 8 and 10 years, respectively, to get people unemployment rate back to where it was before that recession. In economist terms, that's called the scarring of the labour market, and it's what we were determined to avoid.
Yeah.
So that's why we responded with overwhelming economic support, whether it was JobKeeper or what was called the cash flow boost or $750 payments to veterans carers and others on income support, the doubling of the job seeker payment. All of that was designed to cushion the blow for families, boost the economic activity through the economy, and then snap back when we could. And if you look at what happened to the economy over that period, it was a V-shaped recovery. Now, we've been hit again with Delta, and it's a reminder that this virus has twists and turns that you can't necessarily prepare for. But I'm very proud of the fact that we threw everything at it, including the kitchen sink, and the net result has been that more people are in work today than were in work before the pandemic, and our economy was bigger today than before the pandemic, as measured in the last national accounts, and that was ahead of any other advanced economy around the world.
Is there a panic that sets in, you know, when COVID first came to Australia and knowing that, oh my God, the international borders are closing and this is getting real, having one of the biggest jobs to help people out, thinking I have the Australian people's lives on my shoulders?
Well, I think, you know, lots of people had lots of important roles. I was just one of them. But we were determined to do everything that we could, and obviously programs like JobKeeper helped save the country because when they were announced, they immediately boosted consumer confidence and business confidence. And businesses, instead of sacking their staff, were keeping them on. And, you know, you speak to a lot of business people or a lot of workers, and they were not only fearful of losing their jobs or their business, but their house too.
Yeah.
And all their life savings. And to know that we've actually come back as an economy pretty strongly since then is really positive. And yes, we're going through a tough time now with lockdowns in Victoria and New South Wales, but we'll get to the end of it. There is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Your wife, Amy, told me that during that time when COVID hit and you were designing JobKeeper that you did not sleep. She said that you were awake for 24 hours a day. What goes through your mind when you're designing something like that that, you know, really hasn't happened or been designed before? Is there anyone that you speak to? I mean, you mentioned that you had a mentor in John Howard. Do you chat to Peter Costello or just are there people you can lean on for things like that?
Yeah, I talked to Peter and spoke to him through the budget preparation processes, and he's obviously got a great deal of experience and very good source of advice. Simultaneously, John Howard is as well, and I spoke to him before I announced JobKeeper with the Prime Minister and said to him, look, you know, I didn't think, John, that I'd be in a position to announce a economy-wide wage subsidy of this amount of money, especially as a Liberal Treasurer. I didn't think this would be something I'd be doing. Yeah, and he said to me, Josh, at times of national crises, there are no ideological constraints. And it was a very powerful statement and a green light, effectively. Go for it. This is the right thing. And it was. So that was, you know, an important conversation. Simultaneously, other business leaders I was talking to, people who employed thousands of workers across the hospitality sectors, across the retail sectors, who explained, you know, the carnage that was out there at the time. They also explained their commitment to their staff, but not every business had the capacity to fund the wages of their staff ongoing when there was so much uncertainty around. And that's why JobKeeper was so successful and so important, because it suddenly gave businesses certainty that the government had their back.
During the pandemic, I know that a few businesses, I know you did this with a lot of businesses, you picked up the phone randomly. I know some travel agents, cafe owners who have told me that you called them just to see how they were. You listened to their stories, you gave them advice, and they were so taken aback by that. They were so heartfelt that you took the time to do that. You know, you obviously have such a busy job. What made you want to do that?
Well, obviously those are the people who are on the front line, so to speak.
Yeah.
And hearing their stories straight is really helpful. It's an unvarnished way of getting real-time understanding of what was taking place in a lot of these businesses. So that was really helpful. At the same time, today, I'm ringing people across my electorate who may ring into my office and tell us about their own individual stories, and that's also providing an insight into how some of them are either recovering or getting into more and more trouble, effectively. And it's not just on the economic side. You know, I've spoken to a lot of parents about their kids being out of school for a long period of time here in Victoria and the impact that that's having on the mental health of the kids, and indeed that some of the parents who are trying to manage homeschooling with working from home, the anxiety that comes with all of those sort of pressures, the fact that, you know, curfews have been in operation, you can't travel, you know, more than 10 kilometres from your home. And there's a whole range of other factors at play here that has really, I think, taken its toll on people's well-being over the course of this pandemic. And unfortunately, some of those impacts, I think, will be long-lasting.
Are you able, after you hear those stories, to be able to help them?
I'll give you one example. I spoke to a woman who was a single mum. She ran a business in the city. Her business, her shop, normally has 5 staff. And because of the fact that there's hardly anyone there, she's got down to 1 staff. She's at the bottom level of a building that normally has 3,000 people in it, now only has a few hundred in the city. And she had extended her mortgage to have the money basically to keep the store open and to meet the existing costs. Anyway, her rental bill was still there and she hadn't been getting that much relief. And she was very worried about her ability to meet future rental payments. So I found out who the landlord was. It was a big company. I didn't know their management very well. And I just pick up the phone to the managing director. And, you know, obviously they're a bit shocked to get a phone call from the treasurer. And I said, look, this is quite unusual, but I just want to give you the situation here with this single mum, 3 kids, got this business in one of your buildings, wants to get through the pandemic, has extended a mortgage, and she can't meet the rental repayments as they are. Can you give her some relief? And they intervened. They provided her with some extensive relief. She's happy. I'm certainly happy. And, you know, I'm confident she'll be there on the other side.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Josh, you've obviously dealt with a lot more than a lot of politicians have to in their time. that they're in politics. What has been the toughest moment for you thus far?
Toughest moment for me has been as a Victorian to see this state go through the longest lockdown in the world, and particularly to see its impact on kids. I spoke to one lady who rang into my office the other day. I rang back and she said she doesn't care, she hasn't gone to a pub or to a movie for 2 years. What she cares about is her kids go back to school. And I think the decision to keep your kids out of school for such a long period of time is going to have massive educational impacts on kids' development, personal, but also on their emotional development. And I'm really worried about that. And if I have one regret, probably among many, it's that governments weren't more creative about keeping kids in the classroom. Because having them out of the classroom for that period of time, away from their friends, not engaging face-to-face with their teachers, not being able to get the benefit of classroom learning. I think it's been horrible for so many. And as you know, the kids who are most affected are often those from the most disadvantaged backgrounds because they don't necessarily have the equipment at home or the learning environment at home or the parental support at home.
Absolutely.
Can get them through 8 hours of a school day that is not in the classroom but in the living room. We probably don't really fully know as a community yet what the impact is, but Patrick McGorry's given us an insight with his phrase, the shadow pandemic.
Yes.
And over 340 teenagers are tragically turning up, you know, each week to emergency departments with mental health-related issues, which is a 160% increase on the numbers that were happening prior to the pandemic. That's Exhibit A, and there are lots of others, of what this is costing us as a community. And so it's really important to balance the advice and to see the health outcomes as not purely keeping people away from COVID. The health outcomes also include keeping kids and parents, you know, emotionally healthy. And we've got to think about the economic impacts, we've got to think about the mental health impacts of some of these restrictions.
How do you, I mean, we spoke about before, you were obviously away last year for hundreds of days. How do you juggle your family and work life, having two young children and a wife that has an unbelievably successful job as a lawyer?
Well, it starts, obviously, my wife has been incredibly supportive and strong over the course of this pandemic, and she's done, you know, the heavy lifting at home, that's for sure. And that has provided me, I think, with a bit of emotional space to do what I need to do, because if every minute of every day I was either feeling guilty about being away from home or preoccupied from doing my day job, then I think that would have been disastrous. So she's been incredible, and the kids have been at an age where they've managed, you know, to get through this period, although I think it comes to every kid with a cost. And so we've just really focused on doing the little things with them, getting them to the parks, ensuring the routines with meal times and bedtimes. FaceTime with me has been, I've been really focused on that with the family a couple of times a day. And then obviously trying to balance the amount of screen time, because I think that's, you know, you can easily fall into that trap. It's just a fact of life that kids are now much more busy on their screens than certainly we ever were.
Absolutely.
But it's also about getting that balance right. Certainly they've watched a few more episodes of Bluey and Fireman Sam than they normally would have.
Josh, what's become very obvious to a lot of Australians during this time is that the state governments have a lot more power than what we thought. I mean, a lot of the time people in the state wouldn't even know the premier of someone outside of their state's name. But now we know every premier's name in the whole of Australia.
And they're loving it.
Yeah. Tell me, do you think, because we've obviously seen that there's a real big power shift in the fact that the state governments have a lot more power than we thought that they did.
Yeah.
Do you think after the pandemic is over and you're going about looking at what you did well and you didn't, do you think there would ever be a restructure of power between the federal and the state governments?
Well, I think this is confusing for a lot of people because when they've grown up, they've tended to think that it's the federal government that have made the big decisions in their life around national security or border protection or the economy and budget night and taxes and all the things that come with that. And suddenly it's the premier who tells you how far you can go from your home and whether you can see your dying relative or how many people can be at a funeral or a wedding or whether or not you can actually play school sport or go to school. Mm. Or have your small business open. So fundamental decisions in the daily lives of Victorians or people in New South Wales or indeed any other state are being determined by the Premier in a way that has not been the case previously. I don't think it's a permanent feature of our system, by the way. This is obviously what's happening now in the context of a pandemic and the public health orders and what states have responsibilities for. But I do think it's causing a lot of people to question how the roles and responsibilities are divided up. I find, certainly as the federal treasurer, I'm being handed the bill for a lot of state decisions, some of which I obviously don't agree with. And that's another aspect of all this, is that there's huge amounts of money being spent, but it's been the federal government that's done most of that spending. So we have picked up the tab. And of course, you know, we've got a capacity to do so, but we've ended up funding a lot of decisions that were taken at a state level.
Do you know, as the federal government, do you find out about a lot of this stuff in advance? Like, say, for example, Melbourne's going to have a lockdown. Do you find out a day, 2 days in advance, hour in advance?
Not necessarily. When they ring up and ask us to fund it, that's about it. So, yeah, the Prime Minister will get, you know, the courtesy maybe of a call the night before or something like that, but they don't tend to telegraph these things. Different premiers operate differently too, and the relationship between premiers and prime ministers also differ too. I have good relationships with my counterparts, I have to say, and, you know, I've said yes pretty much most of the time when it comes to funding support.
Many countries have resumed overseas travel and normal travel domestically as well. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has mentioned that we are on our way to do that as well, which is fantastic. When do you see our international borders actually opening for international people to come and visit Australia as tourists?
Yeah, I think we're getting to the point where the vaccination rates will be at that 70 to 80% rate. That will give us a lot more confidence and flexibility around international and domestic borders. And certainly our intention is to open those borders when it's safe to do so. And we're transitioning away from hotel quarantine to home quarantine that is being trialled. And I think that's the way forward, certainly long term. We've said that when New South Wales gets to 80% double dose vaccinations, then that's the conversation we're having with them about how does international travel get facilitated at high rates at that point in time. International students, skilled workers, families. I think you'll start to see a lot more travel sooner than later as a result of the vaccination rates getting up the curve.
When travel does resume, how do you see it looking for people who are vaccinated? Do you see there being home quarantine always?
I think we're moving down that path, and certainly that's going to make it a lot easier. And then obviously when you're moving in and out of countries, you're going to have documentation about your vaccination status.
Yeah.
And so that's just how it's going to be. This will give people the ability to travel more freely than they've had because, you know, I think it's very problematic that a lot of people are not able to get back to their own state.
Yeah.
let alone their own country, because some of the restrictions have been put in place.
Will there be, when international borders do open, will there be certain countries that Australians will be able to go to first, or
Be everywhere? There's travel bubbles that have been worked on, and obviously New Zealand's been the one that's already been put in place, but we've been talking about Singapore and Japan and others that potentially, you know, could occur. But again, that work's to be done. Decisions have yet to be taken. And it would depend on the status of the virus, both here and overseas.
Yeah. When you are looking at particular countries overseas who have dealt with the virus well, do you use them now as a guide when making decisions about Australia?
Well, the virus has gone through a number of different phases. And as you know, we moved very quickly to close the international borders, and Australia avoided the fate, let's say, of the United States or the United Kingdom. You know, in the UK, they saw more than 130,000 deaths. In the US, you saw much greater numbers of deaths. And that was a function of the fact that, you know, they didn't put those immediate health-related restrictions in place like we did in Australia. That being said, they've now got to the point where their economy is opened up. People are getting back to living in a COVID normal way, if you like. And there are still lots of cases. There are still large numbers of deaths, but it's been accepted as part of the inevitability of living with the virus. And that's what I've spoken about, the need for Australia and for Australians to understand this is not about eliminating the virus. This is about the suppression and then getting to the point where you are living with the virus despite, you know, there being people who get sick and despite, tragically, some people dying.
Knowing everything that you do now, living through, I mean, nearly 2 years of this pandemic, what would you change as Australia's response for the future if this sort of thing was to happen again?
One of the things that's been brought into focus in this pandemic is the ability to access everything from vaccines to masks to ventilators to the quarantine facilities to the surge capacity of our hospitals. There are all these things that have been brought into question. What we need to do as a country is have a sovereign capability in key areas. We've been fortunate that with vaccines, we've got CSL and their ability to make vaccines here in Australia. It's a real natural advantage. At the same time, masks, we've had to import a lot of that equipment. So we're looking at what sort of permanent capacity we will have here. With ventilators, we were able to get businesses that were making sleep apnea devices to repurpose their machinery to make ventilators. That was very nimble and agile. Likewise, you had gin distilleries down in Tasmania that suddenly were making hand sanitizer. So being able to ensure security of supply for key equipment, I think, is going to be really important for future health pandemics, because they're going to come.
Our final question to all of those Australians listening whose lives have been changed dramatically over the last 2 years, what words of solace would you have for them looking into the future?
Well, firstly, they can be very proud of their part in the Australian response, and they can be very proud of our frontline health workers, our teachers, our Defence Force, and so many other people who have been able to adapt to what have been a series of new challenges through this crisis. The second thing is Australia has avoided the loss of life that has been seen in other comparable countries because we moved early. At the same time, I can see a light at the end of the tunnel, and I can see a point when we come out of these lockdowns, and certainly that is occurring sooner than later as a result of those vaccination rates that have dramatically lifted as more suppliers come on board. So my message to everyone is you can be confident and optimistic about your future here in Australia, and that despite all the challenges everyone has faced, you know, we are getting through this. That being said, there are some people who are doing it tougher than others. and you've got to support one another. Check in with a friend, family member, ask them, are they okay? And if they're not, get them the support that they need. The government also has your back.
Josh Frydenberg, thank you.
Nice to be with you.
Josh Frydenberg podcast with Sarah Grimberg. The audio producer is Matt Curry, and the producer is me, Sarah Grimberg. Listener.